This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a first for the country of Cuba.
A first for all of us, I think. Michael Smith and I went to the Cuban embassy. And when we say first, it was not the Cuban embassy since 1961. So it's a first. And we saw the Cuban flag go up on the flagpole. An amazing moment, and Michael and I will bring you up-to-date details about it.
We also hear from Dan Georgiakis. The situation in Greece didn't get resolved.
Although the people voted no, the government went ahead despite the vote. Dan Georgiakis points a way forward.
How important was President Obama's commutation of the sentences of 46 federal prisoners?
For those 46, critically important. For hundreds of thousands of others, let's see what he does.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, and Michael, I understand that you were both in Washington, D.C. recently, guests of the Cuban government, attending a very special event.
What's the address? 1290 16th Street, Washington, D.C. The embassy, now the Embassy of Cuba, was built in 1917. Michael and I and 500 other stalwarts, I guess you would call us, in the sense of long-term supporters of the Cuban Revolution, lots of Cubans, lots of others, went to the opening of the embassy. We got there, and at 10:30 in the morning, we saw the Cuban flag go up on the pole. A remarkable event, and it was a very hot day. We totally loved every minute. I'll hear Michael's reaction, and then we'll talk some more about it and what it meant.
Well, first of all, it was a great victory for the Cuban people and their government. And we'll talk about that in a minute, about how the Cubans reversed the situation the Americans put them in after the Cuban Revolution. But I just wanted to add, Michael, that it's this elegant limestone building, and the flag that they hoisted that day was the same flag that the United States forced them to take down in 1961. Some guy in Miami kept the flag, and they ratted up the pole again. That's
apparently amazing. I was wrong when I said that. Here's what happened. Michael and I are inside the embassy, and the foreign minister is giving a speech, Bruno.
Bruno Rodriguez.
And he talks about, we have the same flag that was taken down 54 years ago.
Yeah.
But when I said that, someone pointed out, it's not the flag they put up on the pole. Inside, if you saw, there was a flag on the wall.
And that was
the flag from 54 years ago, but it was still very historic. I made a mistake initially.
But wait, what happened in the building in those intervening years?
It was the Swiss embassy and ran it as an interest section for Cuba, like the Swiss did in Havana for the United States. It was the Swiss embassy, the U.S. interest section.
I've actually been in that building.
Right, you've been in it before. It's been so redone and so gorgeous, drop-dead beautiful. And they served, Michael and I went to a bar. Before we get to any politics.
I'm jealous, I wasn't there.
There was first Bruno's speech, which we can talk about, and people should get it online. It's hard-hitting. The Cubans didn't give an inch. He starts going back to José Martí, you know, the 1898 liberation fighter poet who actually, as people may not know, wrote the words to Guantanamo. And he was shot off a horse within a week of getting involved in the battle because he was not a warrior. He was a poet.
And there's a great statue of him in Havana.
Right. Yeah. So they start with José Martí. And then he says José Martí lauded the United States in many ways, but he also warned us that the United States was a voracious partner that would swallow us up. So he starts with that. Then he goes to U.S. domination of Cuba. This is Bruno Rodriguez, the foreign minister, talking to everybody. U.S. diplomats are there and everybody saying, and then the U.S. took Guantanamo and they put the Platt Amendment into our Constitution, which essentially made them part of the Cuban government. Then from there he went on, and then in 1959, the U.S. refused to recognize the revolution we had in our country, and then they continued the depredations of Cuba. And, of course, we still are demanding recognition as an independent country, the lifting of the embargo, as well as the return of Guantanamo.
Michael sounds like a tour de force.
He said that unless the blockade It's economic, commercial, financial blockade. Cuba is totally isolated from the world economy, you know. And unless they lift the blockade, unless they get out of Guantanamo, which they stole and occupy illegally, and until they stop trying to subvert the Cuban government, they spend $30 million a year trying to subvert the Cuban. Mm. They have no regard for Cuban sovereignty. And Bruno Rodriguez said, what we've done today is meaningless. That was his word, meaningless, unless the United States backs off on these three things.
And it was an amazing, wonderful time. We had the best thing Michael and I did. They had a special room upstairs, and they had in his handwriting over the bar, it was a bar, Ernest Hemingway.
Oh.
Ernest Hemingway room.
Yeah, right. It was called that. And there's a picture of Ernest Hemingway and I think Fidel on the wall in black and white. And there's just a complete bar filled with mojitos, which is the Cuban drink. And of course, once we went in there, Michael and I never left.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
well, the Cubans hoisted the flag, and we hoisted the drinks.
But it
had all our friends for years from the Solidarity Movement.
Right.
Really inspiring, and to see the Cubans stand strong in the face of continued U.S. aggression is the only way you can use for what they're still doing. Was remarkable. Michael, any thoughts? Other thoughts about it?
Because I wanted to talk going back to the beginning. Of what happened to the Cubans after the Cuban Revolution, even before the Cuban Revolution. You know, the United States supported the torturing secret police force under the Batista dictatorship, which they supported. And they armed and supplied the Batista army during the revolution, which caused the death of 20,000 Cubans. But finally, by January of 1959, the Cubans had thrown out the Batista dictatorship, and they marched into Havana. They took the Havana Hilton Hotel. They took over the hotel, became the Havana Libre.
Right.
Michael has stayed there. I've stayed there.
It's a great
and you
hotel.
Were there too, Heidi? Yeah.
What room were you in, Heidi?
And
Michael?
I was in the room that Fidel slept in.
No, stop.
I got friendly with the maid. She let me lay down on the bed.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway.
My wife took pictures of Fidel, Karen Ranucci, on many different occasions. And I have one in the house of Fidel laying on the bed.
Oh, no.
And it's in the mission to the UN in New York. And I said, Karen, what's that picture? And she said, well, I was with Fidel that week photographing him with John Alpert at DCTV, following him in probably early 60s and or no, early 70s, maybe whatever year. And I said to Fidel, do something you never do. So Fidel laid down in bed and pretended he was asleep.
Wow.
So, and it's this photograph.
With his guard down.
Of Fidel with his eyes shut.
Amazing.
Laying in a bed at the mission.
Oh.
Well, you know, so they marched into Havana. The first law they passed was a law lowering the age to serve office so that Fidel could be the prime minister because he was only 32 years old. The second law they passed was to make Che Guevara a citizen of Cuba because he was an Argentinian. And the third law was the Great Agrarian Reform Law. And that's what got him into trouble because the Cubans said to the United States, you know, the United States big companies owned all the land. And the Cubans, like, worked on the land and lived in grass huts and, you know, were illiterate and hungry and unhealthy. I mean, it was a really, really poor country. Still is, but it was terrible then.
Right.
And the United States said, you have to pay us for the value of the land. And the Cubans said, we'd be happy to. We'll pay you whatever you listed the value of the land is for tax purposes. So the United States didn't go for the offer. And then the United States closed down the oil refinery, which they owned. So the Cubans ran out of gasoline. The economy was about to grind to a halt. So the Cubans nationalized the oil refinery, then the nickel mines, then the phone company, then the bus company. And that became the Cuban Socialist Revolution. Mm-hmm. And that's what really got the United States angry. So they even stepped up even further their efforts to overthrow it. And those have gone on to this day.
Right.
You know, Chomsky used to say that they went after Cuba because in the hemisphere, particularly at that time, this was an example of what other countries could do to get outside of U.S.
hegemony. It's what Maggie Thatcher, Reagan's friend, said. There is no alternative, Tina. It's either capitalism or capitalism. There is no other alternative. And the United States did the economic and commercial and financial blockade to stunt the growth of Cuba. They very intentionally wanted to cause starvation, unemployment. They said that in their official policy.
Well, they wanted to make an example of it so the rest of Latin America would not follow.
And the other thing they did internationally, Heidi, was they isolated Cuba from the rest of the countries in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Right.
And they told these governments, if you don't support us in isolating Cuba, we're going to get rid of you. And they overthrew the governments of Uruguay, Bolivia, Brazil, Argentina, and most famously Allende, the other 9/11 in Chile. They overthrew him because he supported the Cubans. So they succeeded in isolating the Cubans from the Organization of American States, which incidentally Che Guevara called the Ministry of Colonies.
You know, when people ask me about why we should be so concerned and care about Cuba so much, and Michael and I have talked about this, you know, the two things that were important to me is this is the only society really that I know in this hemisphere that essentially leveled the playing field after the revolution. Mm. They basically made people equal. There were no mm-hmm. rich and no poor.
Right.
And then they insisted on a social safety net, if you want to call it that,
right.
of education, housing,
food.
And their medical
health,
school medical. Is wonderful.
They produced thousands of doctors.
Their medical research.
When I was there in 73 first, I remember hearing a lecture, and he says everybody got to keep their apartments, houses, and their rents are essentially pegged at 5% of their income. Mm-hmm. And the incomes are very low for the United
right.
States. But
right.
But 5%, including electric, everything. Yeah. It was remarkable. Yeah. That was yeah. one aspect that I think people should always understand. And the second one that was particularly important for many people in the world is internationalism.
Yes.
That's where Cuba did things that you would never be aware of or know unless you really understood it. And the main one that I remember, there were a lot, was going into South Africa, going into Angola, when it was fighting, when the right people were trying to free Angola, and then was going against South Africa, trying to keep the, quote, frontline states
South
into
Africa.
Apartheid. And that was in 1976. And I tell the story. I stood in Revolution Square with a construction helmet because I just finished a Vencer Ramos Brigade. It was May 1st, and Workers' Day. And Fidel stood in front of 100,000 people, including me in this little construction hat, and said, there's black blood in every Cuban vein, and we're going into Angola. Mm. And the battle that finally won was in, I think, early 1980s, and the South Africans suffered their first major military defeat. And that was really when South Africa recognized it could not sustain apartheid. Mm-hmm. And then there was the work in Central America. Cuba was the main, if not the primary source, for really revolutions in Nicaragua, support in El Salvador, throughout Central America. Very, very important role. And it should never be forgotten. Its international
right.
solidarity
That's
was unbelievable.
Right. right. Well, remember after, was it Katrina, when the Cubans offered to send doctors to assist.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they still also send 25,000 doctors a year to Venezuela. Mm, they still
right.
do.
Yeah.
yeah.
And look what they did with Ebola. But after the elections, when Bush stole the election in yeah. Florida, they offered to send election monitors. But I just wanted to say one thing. Because the isolation of Cuba was totally reversed, and I believe that was one of the main reasons why the United States decided to recognize him. Because what happened was, there were no countries, except for Mexico, which had a revolutionary tradition, there were no countries that had anything to do with Cuba.
Mm.
And now, there are no countries that don't. Every right. country in Latin America and the Caribbean, and the Organization of American States was going to meet in Panama, and the head of the Panamanian government, who's no leftist, said to the United States, we want Cuba here.
Mm.
And if you don't like it, you don't have to come.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the turning point. And the United States came, and the Cubans came, and we saw the photographs of Raul Castro shaking hands with Obama and so on. But that was the United States was totally isolated. And the UN votes, the votes would be 180 for Cuba and two against. And the two against would be the United States and Israel.
And Israel.
Israel is a classic vote because Israel, yeah. up until recently, after Spain, had the biggest investments in Cuba.
Mm.
And they're voting for the embargo.
Yeah.
Right.
All the orange groves outside of Santiago, they're owned by Israelis, not by the government, but they're huge investments of Israelis.
I also think it's been important over the last several years that as more people, Americans included, have traveled to Cuba, they've begun to question the propaganda and rhetoric of the United States government. They've seen with their own eyes what
exactly.
it's like.
That's why we want the travel to be made legal and open. It's not legal to go to Cuba.
No, I know.
You know?
Yeah.
You have to go with a group, which is expensive, and you have to have what they call a people-to-people program. You have to document what you did and say that you did it. It's not. You can't go to Cuba now, and you can't buy Cuban stuff. That's illegal,
too. I know.
Too.
You can only buy First Amendment-related things like posters and books.
I'll give you a dramatic example of what you can't buy. The Cubans have invented a drug that would prevent amputations of people who have diabetes. And, you know, I do medical malpractice work,
right.
and my partner recently lost his leg. He's got diabetes. And this drug would have saved his leg. Michael and I were speaking with an attorney who was familiar with this, and he said they've been trying to sell this drug in the United States for 2 years, and it's still held up.
Yeah, they're doing things that are against our own interests completely, yeah. Like that. You know, I have two other short stories about this, and then a slightly broader point. You mentioned Mexico is one of the few countries that kept up relations, and that's true, but they were only on certain level. My first trip to Cuba was 1973. I fly to Mexico City because it's the only way to get there other than a boat from Jamaica or something.
Yeah.
Maybe even that wasn't working. So 73, I get to the airport in Mexico City. The CIA is there. They take my picture getting on the plane. You know, 8 or 9 other of us are on a little plane. And it's a DC-3 we get on, which is a 2-hour flight. It's a small propeller plane, 9 of us on the plane. And you can imagine, we're 73, the height of really, almost the height of progressive movements in the United States, at least of anti-war in particular. So we're all completely excited, smoking Cuban cigars. They give us on the plane, they give us rum. And on one side of the aisle, there's a metal plaque that has the map of Chile. And this is, remember, this is June 73. Allende is still president of Chile. He wasn't overthrown until September. There's a map of Chile, and this was the same plane that took Fidel to Chile and then took him all throughout Chile. And it has a map of how how the plane went. On the other side is a map of Vietnam. And it's a map of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This was the same plane that gave supplies to the Vietnamese through the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And it's just a story of solidarity that's unimaginable.
Right.
And when you went to Cuba, the place was filled. Look, the Sandinista Revolution happened in 79. Where do you think Daniel Ortega was living for a period of time?
Yeah.
Except in Havana.
Same
where
place
were,
with Assata Shakur.
Right. Where were all the revolutionaries living? Where were the Black Panthers living? The bar at the Havana Libre was like walking into an incredibly revolutionary atmosphere. So that's one story. The other story is, and it's related to how I got home from Cuba. In 1973, we fly to Mexico City, but as much as Mexico City was willing to do something, it was still under the thumb of the United States. So you couldn't fly back to Mexico City. You had to fly, and I got on a Russian Ilyushin jet in 1973, and it flew me to Madrid. Why Madrid?
No.
Yeah, because you had to go to Madrid, and then I could take a regular plane back.
You couldn't go to Canada?
At least that I couldn't.
Right.
I mean, you know, we had to fly to Spain.
Wow.
We went to Spain, then we flew back. Franco was still in power then. This is 73. He was out in 75. And I won't do it in good Spanish, but people complained to Franco, what are you doing supporting a communist regime? And or Fidel. And he says, Fidel, no es un comunista, es un galleguista. And what that means, he's not a communist. He's from Gallegos in Spain, his family.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what Franco supposedly said. Anyway, now on the broader issue, which I think is important, which is we look at what Obama's done in Cuba. We look at what happened in Iran. We look at, you know, whatever people think about Obama doing these positive things. In some way, as I did on the last show, Michael Smith wasn't here. You were here, Heidi, I think, when we talked about Iran.
Right.
That it's basically the softer glove of imperialism. This is about, we're not going to use weapons anymore in Iran. We're going to continue
diplomatically,
but yeah. Continue to be able to dominate these countries and regions. Yeah. And of course, that's true in the Cuban case as well. They're not giving up that embargo so quickly.
No.
There's going to be all kinds of strings. I mean, and it's even true. Anyway, so I want people to understand that this is, yes, it's better than using bombs on all these places, but it's not necessarily a new United States that's going
right.
to say we're part of the whole world community. It's still going to say we're at the top of the pyramid of that world community.
And that is precisely the point that Bruno Rodriguez made at the embassy when we were standing there, Michael. He said, this might be just a change of your methods. And if it is, we'll stand up against it.
I didn't remember that, Michael. That's great. Not great, but that's exactly what we're saying. And I think that's right. That this country, which has been a imperialist country since before it was founded, you know, remain so. And let's understand that. And their methods may change. Sometimes they'll be softer. Sometimes they'll be harder. But in the end, it's the dominant country.
Yeah, I wrote an article about it for The Independent, and we'll post the article at lawanddisorder.org for you folks.
It's a great piece. It's a must read. Best damn musical I've read in years.
Anyway, everybody, their uncle wants to go to Cuba. Travel is up 16%. It's hard to get there. It's hard to get a hotel room. That being said, go to Cuba, see for yourself. It's truly extraordinary what a small island like has a population of Pennsylvania, what they've been able to accomplish in the teeth of American hostility for over 50 years is truly a remarkable tribute to their spirit, to their leadership, and to an organized economy.
You know, it always reminds me of the slogan they used in the Sandinista Revolution, and that's who remained in Cuba. Only the workers and peasants stayed till the end. And I think that's right. Now, Fidel made a statement at another point when something changed for the Cuban-U.S. relations. I don't remember what issue, or they won the battle of when they won at Bay of Pigs. And he made this statement, which is completely appropriate today. He said, "We are in a decisive moment of our history. Tyranny has been defeated. The happiness is immense. However, there is still much to be done. Let's not deceive ourselves believing that from now on everything will be easy. Perhaps everything from now on will be more difficult." Fidel Castro.
Absolutely.
So I think appropriate for today.
Well, there's one more plug I wanted to make, Michael, and that's for our book, Who Killed Che,
right.
That Michael Ratner and I wrote, because it has this whole history in it. It's about Che, but it has the context of the Cuban Revolution. And it's an OR book. You can get it online, Who Killed Che by Michael Smith and Michael Ratner.
And just remember, patria morte, venceremos. Michael Smith, you reminded me that we're going to be broadcast on July 26th. Now, everybody thinks the Cuban Revolution prevailed roughly January 1st, 2nd, 3rd of 1959. But that's never been the major anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. When I was there in 73, I was there roughly around July 26th. And they were taking us in a bus. We never made it through for maybe the bus broke down or something to Santiago, Cuba, for July 26th, because that is what's considered, if you want to say, el corazón, la corazón de la revolución.
The heart,
The heart of the revolution is Moncada. And that's the attack that took place in 1953.
1953, July 26th, organized by Fidel.
Right. And it's Moncada is a military garrison in Santiago de Cuba. I visited it half a dozen times in my life. There's black and white pictures all around it of the scores of people who were killed by Batista's forces. And they were killed, not necessarily in the attack, but they were tracked down and murdered as prisoners, a lot of them.
Or tortured.
Right. But it's still looked at as the event that began the revolution. And it's the movement that came out of that, that Fidel started with others, is called the July 26th Movement, based on the Moncada.
Well, they were all young people. These were people in their 20s at most. And their plan was to attack the Moncada barracks. Batista, the dictator that the United States supported, had an office in the Moncada barracks. And they almost got him. He snuck out a secret door in the back, you know. But that was the plan. It utterly failed. And they retreated to Mexico. They trained. And they came back in 1956. And there were 80 of them.
Fidel got captured. Okay,
oh, yeah.
In
well, Moncada. We should talk about that, too,
Fidel
of
got captured in 53. And the guy who captured him, it's a story I don't remember the facts of, was he's going to murder him. And somehow, for some reason, he convinced him, or there was some connection, that they didn't murder Fidel. And then Fidel got put on what's called the Isle of Pines, a large island off the southern coast of Cuba that's now called Isla de la Juventud, the Isle of Youth. And that's where tens of thousands of people were trained from around the world, or educated from around the world, from poor countries all over the world, socialist countries and others. But in any case, after 2 years, at his trial, before he got put on Isla de la Juventud, he gave the famous speech called History Will Absolve Me. And it's worth reading because it's
online. History Will Absolve Me.
It's a story of how they've tried every peaceful means of changing. They failed and they had to take to the streets. He gave that speech without a note, which, of course, is nothing amazing for Fidel, who can go for 6 hours without a note. But he gave that speech. It became very famous. And he did 2 years in prison. And then there was a huge clamoring to let him out. And he did get out. And there's great pictures of him leaving Isla de la Juventud prison. And clearly, if you're going to say the biggest mistake Batista ever made was that. He then goes, as Michael Smith was about to relate, to Mexico City.
And there they organized. They had help from a general who had been active against Franco dictatorship in Spain, Alberto Mayo. And the general helped train them. And they trained 80 troops. Che Guevara was one of them. And they came back on the Granma. There's truly a boat. You know, you could put the whole thing in Michael's basement. And they came back on that. They landed in the wrong place a day late. They got sabotaged by Batista's troops. Only 20 of them lived. They went into the hills. And that became the beginning of the guerrilla warfare. Anyway, we all celebrate that on July 26th. We offer you this radio program on July 26th in solidarity with Cuba.
As a small footnote, other than Fidel surviving through all of these actions from Moncada to the landing in Cuba to Bay of Pigs, there was one other person at the reception whose name I can't recall. He's 86. He was at the embassy reception. He actually was in Moncada as a young man. He then went to Mexico, survived the landing on the beach where most of them were killed, along with Che, of course, who survived, and then went on, I think, to Bay of Pigs, and is a remarkable. He's one of the three people who's been through all of that who's still alive.
He has 9 lives. Two weeks ago, we spoke with Dan Georgiakis, a regular columnist for the Greek-American newspaper, The National Herald. Dan is the co-author of Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, and was a frequent contributor to the now-defunct Journal of the Hellenic Diaspora and the Journal of Modern Hellenism. Dan has taught at NYU, CUNY, the Van Arsdale Labor College, Columbia University, and the University of Oklahoma. Dan Georgiakis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, glad to be back talking with you.
You know, things have changed dramatically in Greece, and we wanted to get your take on what's happened recently, subsequent to the elections and the decisions that the Greek government has made.
Well, as most people know, the Greek public voted oihi, which is no, to the proposed austerity measures offered by the Eurozone. They went back to negotiate, and they found out that the terms were, instead of modified, they were strengthened, and Tsipras, the Prime Minister of Greece, was faced with the possibility of either walking out or giving in, as it were. And he decided to give in because badly, and this speaks badly for them, they had no plan B. They did not believe the Eurozone would be so thoughtless as to not listen to the general public and would at least make some kind of concessions instead of upping the stakes. And they had not prepared for the closing of the banks. They had not prepared for printing new money. They had not taken all those precautions that a plan B would have had. So he went forward and agreed. He went to Parliament because Parliament has to agree to these things. And most of his own party, not most of his own party, but 50 members of his own party voted against him. And so the measure was carried mainly through the support of his opponents, New Democracy and Potami. The question rises now is, where do we go from here? And two things come up. One is the government can go forward with some of the cuts that they've asked for because some of them are good. The Greek bureaucracy is terrible, and nobody will shed one tear to see that cleaned up. I think you could have all kinds of prosecutions of people who had participated in the corrupt loans. You could crack down on taxpayers. But it wouldn't make any sense if you also didn't put in a second line. And a second line, which is what the left people in Greece are suggesting, is that they begin considering nationalizing the banks, preparing machines. They don't even have machines that can print new money. Make up a real transition plan, because if they go to the drachma, there's a lot of details that have to be thought out. You can't just play it by ear. So they've bought time to do that. The question is, will the government decide to go that route and say, we'll prepare to leave the Eurozone because this is just too terrible, or will it just accommodate and move to the center, losing probably part of its membership and going into a coalition government with more moderates. So those are the two alternatives. From a distance, it's easy to say, oh, do this or that. But when you're in Greece itself, it's pretty hard to know what the right course is. But more and more people are saying, what's the advantage of being in the Eurozone? They do want to stay in the EU. They want to have the freedom of travel, and they want other possibilities that you get from the EU. So they really prefer, the people that are, say, get out of the Eurozone, prefer to stay in the EU and just become one of the other countries that has two currencies.
Varoufakis, as you know, the former finance minister, he resigned. He said that Greece was presented with two alternatives. One was execution and the other was suicide. Are you thinking that to try to prevent a suicide, nationalizing the banks and the other means that you described would try to prevent that?
It would work in those directions. The point is you have to have a plan, and it seems that one of the problems with this government includes Varoufakis, who admits it, is they didn't go in with a plan B.
Now, that's what I'd heard, and you had mentioned it maybe before. I don't recall if it was you. And that seems like amazing to me. I mean, what did they think?
Well, they naively thought the Eurozone would do its in its own best interest in the long run. Because I think what has happened, I call it the Fourth Reich, the new financial occupation of Greece is a Pyrrhic victory. Because all over Europe, people are saying, wow, when it comes to the interests of the banks versus the interests of the public, it's going to be the interests of the banks. And these people are very, very clever. What they did in 2010, 2012 is they gave bailouts to the Greeks, but they used that time to take all the money that was held in private hands and move it over to the European banks so that if that was their plan B, so that if Greece leaves the Eurozone, then the public will have to pay the debts. We'll take the haircut instead of private institutions. So that's how they used these last 2 years. So the question, the challenge now is, what will Syriza do with the year or two that it has bought with this terrible waterboarding package?
A couple of questions about Syriza right now, and about its status, what the splits are in it, and whether you really think there's a chance they're going to, you know, move toward a position of some of the things you're telling us should be done if they want to have any kind of negotiating power.
Well, there's something called the Left Platform in Greece, in Syriza, and other radicals. And they want to stick with the prime minister as much as they can, but at a certain point, it's just hopeless. So there's a lot of discussion now of what strategy is possible in the next year or two without losing the government and without going into chaos. And as I say, it's easy for people distant to reach those kind of decisions. But for instance, just a simple thing that most people wouldn't even think about, small Greek islands import almost everything. Well, they've been excluded from the VAT tax. Now they're going to get 23% VAT tax, which may vacate those islands. They may not be able to stay on those islands. Medicine, all kinds of day-to-day things that if you just suddenly abruptly leave the Eurozone without a plan could cause maybe even worse than the present situation. So it's a tough call, and it's going to take some really clever thinking and planning for the Greeks to come out on top. What I would say, though, is that if, in fact, they were able to leave the Eurozone in some rational fashion, and then within a year or two were successful, this is probably the nightmare that the Fourth Reich faces.
That was my next question. I mean, what impact would this have on the rest of Europe, particularly the poorer countries of Southern Europe, Spain, Portugal, even Ireland? What impact do you think this all is going to have on those countries who are also in trouble financially?
Well, the first impact is that everybody is, throughout Europe, people are disillusioned with the vision of the Eurozone, which was supposed to give prosperity for all the people in it. Somebody has compared it to the Articles of Confederation after the in the United States, which just didn't work. And I don't think Europe is ready to go to a constitution. So there's a crisis, and I think the biggest of victors in this new crisis will be the right wing, because they'll say, see, they don't really care about us. Doesn't matter if we stay in or out, and so on and so forth. And I expect to see a surge in the right-wing vote throughout Europe. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal, not your normal radical newspaper, has stated that this decision has, which was, the EU was created to prevent the resurgence of Nazism, and these kind of decisions are actually feeding it. That's pretty strong for the Wall Street Journal.
We only have a minute or so, but anything you want to wind up with, your prognosis for the next couple of years, what you're thinking is, do you have some optimism, et cetera?
Well, my greatest optimism is with the Greek people. The fact that they voted Orhi, the fact that on an island like Mytilene, which is in big trouble, suddenly gets swamped with Syrian refugees from the war there. What do? They open their doors. They take care of the people. It all depends on the Greek people. Frankly, I have confidence. Perhaps I'm naive. Give them a good plan, and they'll go for it.
Dan Georgiakis, thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Using his presidential commutation power sparingly, President Barack Obama recently ordered the release of 46 nonviolent drug offenders. Despite his calls for reducing the size of the nation's prison population, and despite making history as the first president to visit a federal prison, his record on pardons and commutations is not great. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, which has recorded clemency statistics since William McKinley's presidency, Obama has granted the least number of recorded pardons in history. President Obama also has the fourth lowest number of recorded commutations. Here to talk about the president's recent actions is Susan Rosenberg, a human rights and prisoners' rights advocate, adjunct lecturer, communications consultant, award-winning writer, public speaker, and a formerly incarcerated person. Her memoir, An American Radical, details her 16 years in federal prison, as well as her conclusions about her prison experience and her past.
Susan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Much has been made in the press recently about President Obama's ordering the release of 46 nonviolent drug offenders, as they call them. And we wanted to get your take on what this means symbolically. Is it a drop in the bucket? How does it compare to other presidents?
Well, is it a drop in the bucket? Yes, definitely. Is it a good drop? Yes. I think the more people that the president releases under his powers, the better. But it is definitely a very small amount. I'm involved with a group of women who are organizing to advocate for the release of 6,000 women federal prisoners in one session, that President Obama can do that if he chooses to. So, that would be an incredible thing to have that number of people released. So 46 is great, but it's very small.
What are the figures on how many presidents have released how many people over the years?
I've read different things. I think he up until these recent pardons, he was very low on the numbers. He has not granted very many pardons or clemencies. Other presidents have used the power in a broader way, but, you know, he still has time, so hopefully he'll pick that up.
What are the differences between a pardon and clemency?
A pardon is when your entire record is wiped clean. It is as though you did not commit whatever it was that put you in prison or convicted to begin with. There are different kinds of clemency, but clemency is you have served enough time. Your punishment has reached the point where it is no longer relevant or necessary, and so, you know, you're released.
These are actually, I guess I refer to them broadly maybe as commutations versus pardons. And of course, in a commutation, you don't actually get the right to restore your right to vote so easily or, you know, whatever other kinds of things. But on the broader question, how many, there's millions of prisoners and there's hundreds of thousands of federal prisoners. Is he going to really make a dent? It's very late in his administration. 46 just seemed, yeah, sure, it's good, but it just seemed minuscule to me.
Yes, I mean, I agree. It's not going to make a dent. I think that, you know, in the media currently, there's a lot of discussion about President Obama's speech at the NAACP and the fact that the last few months of his administration, he's going to take on some of the issues of reform in the criminal justice system. And it's late. It's very late in the process, I think. And, you know, certainly he hasn't done what he initially said he would do about Guantanamo and the whole issue of American torture and what the United States government has been doing with that. I think, you know, these issues, Guantanamo, the federal sentencing, the death penalty, these things are all related. So, you know, we'll have to see if a mass movement can advocate and agitate to say to him, listen, release several thousand people. Again, that's not going to stop mass incarceration, but it would certainly impact the lives of those numbers of people.
Susan, what do you make of the recent trend that we're seeing of conservatives as well as liberals coming together and reaching some agreement on the issue of our over-criminalization, mass incarceration, criminal justice crisis?
Well, I think it's an important development in the sense that I think it will empower a reform, a series of potential reforms of the system. But I don't think that they are in any way going to address the underlying deep crisis that is going on with American punishment as a whole. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion, certainly in the left, about, you know, this idea that everything must be across the aisle, meaning the Republicans and the Democrats, and, you know, that's going to make things move forward. I think this is a deeper set of contradictions. You know, it's kind of like, should we reform what's going on at Rikers Island, or should we close it? You know, it's kind of like that.
You know, I was suspicious, I admit to having that reaction, when I first heard that Obama had let out the 46. I was also happy about it. But I was wondering, what do you think it was that motivated Obama, and what motivated this left-right coalition? What underlies it? Is it the mass movement? Is it they think they're spending too much money on it? I mean, where are they coming from?
I think they're coming from both of those places. I think that they realize that this is not working, this is not effective for whatever their specific goals are, and that really there has to be some change. But I really do, I agree with you in the sense that I think that what he's doing now, it's like a release valve. You know, it's just to release the profound pressure. You know, having been in prison myself, the difference between being in prison and being out is, you know, it's unbelievable. It's enormous. But I think for the individuals that will be affected by what he's doing, I'm ecstatic and really happy that they will have some life that goes on outside of the prison walls, on the one hand. On the other, that it's not really addressing the racism of the system, the profound impact of capitalism. These are all, you know, the underlying things that I think are at issue in our criminal justice processes.
Susan, I want to go back and look at the 46 for a moment, because when they announced it, they said these are nonviolent drug offenders. What the criteria used, which might be better to have other criteria, like is this person going to commit a crime, et cetera, whatever the criteria, what do you make of the word nonviolent in that, and what's your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's the easiest group of people to release, and they certainly should be released. But I think that by pitting violent versus nonviolent, what happens is that it kind of it takes the meaning of punishment away, right? Because if you're convicted of something, quote, violent, you've been sentenced for that. You've been punished for that, right? So you're doing your prison time as a result of that. And we have this idea of parole. We have this idea of change. We have this idea of redemption in America. And all of that gets put aside when we codify this difference between nonviolent and violent. I think it's very problematic because there are many, many people in prison. There's, you know, a huge number of people in New York State prisons who are in prison for 25, 30, 35, 40 years, all of whom are eligible for parole, none of whom are getting parole because, quote, their offense will never be changed.
That's right.
Well,
that's right.
Kind of the whole point of why you go to prison to begin with.
Yeah. Well, they used to call them correctional facilities, but that's a joke.
Yeah, well, no question.
Susan, your sentence was commuted by President Clinton on January 20th, 2001, his final day in office. I'm curious, did you have advance notice that this was a possibility?
Yes. I mean, in a certain sense of, like, there were rumors that were coming out of the White House. But, you know, no. I mean, I did not know until I was informed in the legal visiting room at Danbury, you know, after, actually, he was leaving the White House. I believe it was his very last act.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
I want to go back to your mentioning of a program you're working on of freeing 6,000 women. And can you talk about that a little bit? Are they federal? Are they state?
Where they're
you're
federal.
Get, and
they're
how,
federal.
And what's it like? How can people find out more about it?
Well, there's an organization that's advocating for this. It's called justiceashealing.org. It's run by a wonderful woman named Andrea James, who has been was in federal prison herself briefly and came out and said, you know, this just has to stop. The criminalization of mothers, of women, of, you know, young women, the waste of life, I don't even have to go through that. But she has been involved in the Open Society, who are doing criminal justice reform work, along with many, many formerly incarcerated women who were in federal prison. And actually, there's going to be a conference about this at Harvard in August, to try and rally and come up with some very specific demands that will enable us to go to President Obama again.
Are these formerly incarcerated women that are going to be at this conference?
Yes, it's the entire group of people who are speaking are all formerly incarcerated. I think maybe with one or two exceptions.
Amazing. I want to go back to what Obama did again, because when I read the article, I see the 46. And it said he has a special office set up and that 30,000 people applied for a commutation or clemency. And he gave it to 46. And yes, those others are still being considered. But if they're leaking them out, like a few at a time, and there may be of the 30,000, perhaps all of them might fit his criteria, or a majority might fit his criteria. Are we ever going to see anything like that of those 30,000 or the 6,000, which there may be some crossover of the people you're working on behalf of?
You know, I think it depends on how well we can organize and how well we can push for it. I mean, I don't think we've seen a lot of huge risk-taking from President Obama. For him to do something like that, it will be a risk. It will be important. You know, it is true that presidents take these actions and then there's a lot of blowback on it. But I don't want to say it's impossible, because I hope that that's not the case. But, you know, I think it's going to take a lot of effort. And the whole idea that what's going on now vis-a-vis the police and the Black Lives Matter movement, and the, almost some ways it seems to me it's a race war that's going on in the United States, although it hasn't been called that. You know, if that movement can link with the prison movement that's trying to get people out of prison, then I think we would have a different kind of social and political movement.
We're speaking with Susan Rosenberg, a formerly incarcerated person who's very active in trying to get prisoners out. Susan, we learned that the Brown versus Board of Education decision that desegregated, at least legally, formally desegregated schools, came about because of the bad rap the United States was getting internationally as being this segregated country. And do you think that international opinion has something to do with addressing the problem of mass incarceration and racist incarceration here?
No. I wish it did. I used to believe that, there was the shame factor, you know, the exposure factor. But I think the fact that the United States has been so successful in denying the existence of political prisoners in the United States, despite, you know, international exposure and effort, is an indication of how committed they are to their own criminal injustice processes. In terms of international law, there have been some important successes. I will tell you that the entire time that I was incarcerated, I had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in my cell. You know, I kept that up as a way to think about something beside the terrible, repressive U.S.-based punishment. But if you look at, you know, the Juan Mendez and, excuse me, the international...
UN Rapporteur on Torture.
Yeah, the UN Rapporteur. You know, he's done an enormous amount. He's gone into Pelican Bay. He's come out in support of Mumia. I mean, numbers of things. And, you know, it's certainly the whole issue of Guantanamo and torture. But and taking the position that solitary confinement under international law is a form of torture. Very, very important. And it certainly validates all of the work that's been done. But it has not, I do not think that is a factor in what's going on now.
Susan, the figures, and we've talked about them here on the show before, people in solitary on any single day is something like 80,000 in the United States.
Yeah, and I think that's a low number, actually.
In the UK, it's less than 5, I think, or something like that. But I'm interested, the president did two things recently. One was visit a federal prison, the first president to do that. And secondly, gave a talk about, he didn't say abolish solitary, he just said we have to limit the numbers very much. I'd like to your reaction to both of those actions by the president and whether you think they're going to have very much meaning and how significant they are.
I have a mixed reaction. On the one hand, that is such a statement that no president has before him ever been to a prison, given the enormousness of the whole prison industrial complex, how much it costs the U.S. government, you know, the totality of it is as a part of the system. The fact that he went, I think, is an important for him to say to the American public, you know, it could have been me. I think that that's a very profound statement, and I have a lot of respect for him for doing that. But I think his intention is to, in a very kind of narrow way, make some small reforms to this process, you know, and it isn't about deconstructing some of the very serious underpinnings that keep the system going.
I want to go back, because I think you've emphasized throughout this interview the importance of mass movements on this issue and not just looking at the top. And you mentioned one specific idea. I'd like to hear more about it, that idea as well as others, is the somehow coming together of the Black Lives Matter movement, the movements around what's happening in our streets every day, and the incarcerated movement. And can you just elaborate that a little bit of how you see that happening or possibly working?
Well, I think that we who have been organizing around prisons and around racist, anti-racist politics for many years and around supporting political prisoners are trying to bring a connection and make the connections between these movements within all of these movements. And I think that that's got to be really critical. I think, you know, if you look at some of the Black Lives Matter activism in California, there is the connection there that's being made between prisons and the police and policing and what that has meant for the lives of people in that community. So you know, I think that it's really important that that happens.
Susan, we just have a minute left. A parting thought that I have is Barack Obama's last day in office. Are you aware if there's a limit to the number of individuals that a president can pardon? I'm imagining him letting thousands out.
Me too. Boy, what a great thought, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I wouldn't bet on it.
I don't know if there's a limit. You know, as I said earlier, I think, you know, it's going to take a big leap to do even a few hundred more. And, you know, I'm hoping he'll release as many as he possibly can.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think there's no limit, but I think if he does a few hundred, I will be shocked to start with, but I hope I'm wrong.
The limit, Michael, is that he's hoping that a Democrat will get elected after he leaves, and he doesn't want to hurt that person's chance.
Who knows?
Oh, well, we'll see.
Yeah. But listen, thank you very much, Susan, for having me on.
Thank you.
And, if I teach this stuff, I live this stuff, I breathe this stuff, so if there's any other time you want to call on me, please feel free to do that.
We'd love to. We need some sources for our listeners.
Right.
Give us some websites. You gave us one already. Repeat that one and any other ones you want to throw out there.
The ReleaseAgingPrisonersProject.org is an interesting one. Probably, the Political Prisoners website, the JerichoMovement.org, Prison Radio. I guess those are the ones.
What about the one? Do you have one for the 6,000 people, the 6,000 women?
That was the Justice as Healing.
JusticeAsHealing.org.
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to read.
And finally, Susan, your own book, An American Radical.
Please read my book. It's a different kind of memoir about prison than Orange is the New Black. I was in prison for over 16 years, and for almost 10 of them, I was in solitary confinement or maximum security or small group isolation, and was viewed by the government as, quote, a terrorist. And my definition was the political prisoner. So, you know, I experienced that time in prison through a certain perspective. So I think your readers might be interested in it.
That's an American radical.
Yep,
thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Bye, Susan.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.